This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When most of us read a menu, it's about deciding what we want to eat. When Dan Jurafsky looks at a menu, he's studying the words that are used to describe the food, the way the sounds of words can tell you about taste, the origins of the foods, and the feelings words convey about food. He's also deconstructed reviews of restaurants and what they reveal about the reviewer and the experience of dining. Dan Jurafsky is a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University, a past MacArthur Fellow, and author of a book called The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. And Dan Jurafsky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Are you a linguist and a foodie?
I am. Although, you know, the word foodie these days, it doesn't sound as good as it used to, I think. Maybe we're going to start coming up with some other word.
I wanted to ask you about that because I think foodie has become a pejorative. And as a linguist, what do you make of that?
Well, foodie technically we call it a diminutive. It ends in that IE. That is the same ending that we use for kids' names, you know, Danny and Robbie. And those diminutives, they can be affectionate or they can be pejorative. And I think foodie is sort of making that transition.
Well, you live in San Francisco, so it's hard not to be a foodie, isn't it, in that city?
There's a lot of eating, a lot of good eating here, I will say that.
So what is it like to have dinner with you at a restaurant?
Well, I do spend a lot of time reading the menu. But otherwise it's quite normal.
And when you read the menu, and we're going to be talking with someone in a couple of minutes about how people read the menu, how do you read it?
Well, I just look at the words. That's really, you know, I'm a linguist, and so I look at the adjectives and why, and I think about why they're there. And you know, in the various studies we can talk about, we look at how the words are really conveying things, subtle things about the restaurant.
In fact, and it's some interesting research, you look at the menu for a high-end, more expensive restaurant and a more sort of moderate fare restaurant, and the use of words, the use of adjectives, even the number of words is dramatically different.
It's very different.
Yeah, take us through that. Go ahead.
Well, we looked at a lot of menus. This is a study where we looked at 6,500 menus. And so, of course, this is a study where we wrote software to analyze the menus and count all the words. And we found really striking differences between the expensive and cheaper menus. So, for example, a cheaper menu is much more likely to use the word you. So you'll see phrases like your way, any way you like them, your choice. Whereas the expensive menus, it's the word chef that appears much more often. So you'll see chef's choice or chef's selection. So just in that choice of words, you're seeing that for inexpensive menus, it's really it's about you, the diner, making your choice of what food you want to eat. The expensive restaurants, it's a little bit more like theater. It's focused on the chef. You're going to this expensive place for an evening out, and you're going to find what the chef wants.
Well, you also found that in expensive restaurants, they use longer words, and you even analyzed it and said for every extra letter, they charge 69 more cents.
Yeah, exactly. The you might see, for example, on a cheaper menu, you might have decaf, or an expensive menu, you might have decaffeinated. But you also find these really difficult, fancy words that you just might not know what they mean. Tonorelli or Bastilla or Persiade. So some, you know, each of these words is borrowed from a foreign language. They're long words. People might not know what they mean. It's, you know, maybe it's a chance for a restaurant to show that they're a little higher class, and so that you're getting something for your money.
I've also noticed that it tells you, you know, beef or lamb from a particular farm or a particular region. It seems that locale matters a lot in these more high-end restaurants.
Very much so. So we call this provenance, and we looked at whether restaurants mention provenance when they talk about the food. And sure enough, the expensive restaurants, they use words like green market cucumbers or talk about the farm or something being grass-fed or pasture-raised 15 times more often than the cheaper restaurants. Well, and like a lot of things with expensive restaurants, these things are beginning to trickle down. You know, people care about where their food comes from, and restaurants are sensitive to that. And so it begins with the expensive restaurants, which can afford to really care. But my suspicion is we've already begun to see it trickling into the middle price restaurants, and you know, who knows, it'll be at McDonald's soon.
Well, I've eaten at all of those restaurants, including fast food and franchise restaurants. And one thing that's so obvious is just you have many more choice. It's a much bigger menu. Even the material that the menu is made of is very different as well. And their pictures often.
Yes, all those are true. So just to take your first point, the cheaper the menu, the longer the menu, the more dishes. And this is related to this first idea that cheaper restaurants are about choice, about giving you lots of options. The expensive restaurants, because they're about the chef, you know, often they're a tasting menu. So you have no choice at all. You come in and the very expensive restaurants, that's all you get. My wife and I went to a very fancy restaurant in San Francisco the other day, and there was no menu at all.
Oh, wow.
They very kindly emailed it to me afterwards, and it was very delicious. But the menu was very, very, even the one they mailed me, you know, there's one name for each dish. So these are very, you know, again, it's like theater. You don't ask the playwright to mail you the script of the play before you go to the theater. You know, you're trusting in whatever it is that they're going to produce for you. And that's kind of the same for these high-end restaurants.
The elevation of the chef, yes?
Yeah, very much so. And it's cyclical, if you think about it. You know, 100 years ago, there were lots of completely different ways to express being fancy. So, of course, the fancy restaurants' menus were in French, because French was the fancy language of the time. And even if you were an Italian restaurant 100 years ago, you would use French words to indicate that you were a high-class Italian restaurant. And restaurant menus could be long. A fancy restaurant could have a very long menu 100 years ago. So, you know, these things cycle. You know, you need to find a way to indicate I'm fancy. And when the less fancy places start copying those signals, then you got to come up with some new ones.
Have you noticed the sort of more nutritional information on menus? I mean, everyone is concerned about calories and things like that. How does that factor in? Or does it?
I mean, there's certainly legal issues in some states about chain restaurants and what they have to say about on their menu. But we haven't seen as much on menus as we have on other products. So, for example, we looked at potato chip bags.
Yeah.
And this was a great story. I taught a freshman class called The Language of Food. And so it was a way to get freshmen interested in linguistics. And my freshman, Josh Friedman, had this idea of looking at the language on potato chip bags. And being a college freshman, he had no money. So he went to the local grocery store and he took pictures of all of the potato chip bags with his phone. And then we brought them back to class and we analyzed them. But we found, for example, that potato chips are covered in the language of health. Potato chips turn out to be a secret health food.
I didn't know that.
it's amazing, like how there's no trans fats and how they're healthier so that's already impressive. But we also found that the more expensive the chip, the more likely they are to talk about health. Sometimes two or three times as much.
I don't know whether I know you're not a nutritionist, you're a linguist, but help us understand why everything now is gluten-free. Do you have an answer to that?
I guess customers, so obviously there's people who have celiac disease, so it's good that we're serving them. And I think, but in general, I think people pick up on trends, and food marketers are very quick to figure out that customers are interested in something. But there's also something about the free, just ignoring the gluten question. We're very emphasizing what's not in our food. And just to take those potato chips as an example, the more expensive the potato chip, the more they talked about what wasn't in the food. So you got, you know, not like any chip, no fluorescent orange, not greasy. So it's as if to be an expensive chip, we're going to tell you, you know, we're not like those other chips that have all these bad artificial stuff in them. We don't have any of those. So there's this model, we call it natural authenticity. There's this model of being authentic food that doesn't have stuff added to it.
You also have compared reviews and also how expensive restaurants use really kind of sexy language to describe things, and also how, and I guess these are reviewers on Yelp.
So, yeah, exactly. We've looked at the same like 6,000 restaurants. We looked at almost a million reviews on the web. So people reviewing the restaurant on Yelp, what do they say about the reviewer? And we thought, well, these are just going to be people talking about food, and we'll learn about how people discuss food. But what we found was that really these words they use in the review are an expression of their own psychological state. So, for example, when people write a one-star review, So this is these are 5-star scales. So 1-star review, they don't really like the restaurant at all. We thought, oh, they're going to talk about how, you know, bland or insipid or greasy the food was. No, it turns out when they write a 1-star review, they use the exact same language that people use when they've suffered trauma. So there's been lots of studies of the language of people, you know, who write blog posts after 9/11 or students after a campus tragedy. What do they write in the campus paper? And there's a specific kind of language they use. They use the past tense more than the present tense. Mm. And they talk about other people a lot. And in particular, they use the words we, us, and our way more often than they should by chance. And that's so the idea is that, you know, you've been traumatized, some bad thing happened, but it happened to us as a group. So collectively, we're going to get through this difficult times together. And that's what we see in the 1-star reviews. People say, we were ignored. The waitress yelled at us. None of us will ever go back. They use us way more often than I.
And what about a 4-star? What's the language of a 4-star review?
Yeah, so in a 4-star review, it seems to depend on whether the restaurant is expensive or cheap. So in an expensive restaurant, there's the sex you were talking about. So we'll talk about orgasmic pastry or creamy or voluptuous cake or my very favorite, very naughty deep fried pork belly.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, so that's your expensive restaurants. Your cheap restaurants, we seem to categorize them as a drug. So we talk about craving and addictive French fries and how the chocolate must have crack in it. So there's something about a cheap food where we're embarrassed. You know, it's unhealthy. It's a junk food. And by talking about it as an addiction, it's a way to say, well, it's not my fault I ate that food. You know, it made me eat it.
And with the more sexy food, that this is sort of, I'm being kind of naughty by eating or enjoying it?
Yeah, I think there's some naughtiness and there's some idea that well, you know, it's natural that food and sex are naturally related, right? They're sensual pleasures. But why only the expensive food is talked about as sex? Yeah, there's something about this metaphor that maybe it's about romance and about dates. I'm not really sure why.
Mm. About a minute before we have to take our first break here, and I'm interested in this gluten-free idea because, of course, there's, you know, fat-free and sugar-free, and it seems even I'm curious about the kind of language on products or foods when it is, you know, without all these things that people are so concerned about. Has that changed, do you think, the marketing of food or how even people sort of read through the labels because they want to stay away from something?
Oh, I'm sure that's true. I mean, there's a lovely study, actually at Penn by Paul Rozin, who
we know him well. Yes.
Yeah,
disgust.
Exactly. And he also looked at, you know, whether you take things out of food or add things to them, people, you can take something out of food and add it back in, and people somehow think of it differently, even though it's the same thing. You take out the sugar, put the sugar back in, people think of it differently. So there's something about additives that viscerally feels wrong to us. I think that's the intuition that marketers are picking up on here with this.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dan Jurafsky. He's a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University. And he's written a book called The Language of Food, subtitled A Linguist Reads the Menu. We're going to take a very short break. We've got another guest waiting in the wings and we want to hear from you. Any thoughts, questions, comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscowane. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. When we took my grandmother-in-law out to dinner, she always read the menu from right to left, picking the cheapest price and then reading backwards to the entree. Most of us don't do that. Well, joining us is Sybil Yang, and she studies how people read menus. She also consults on menu design. She's an assistant professor at San Francisco State University's Department of Hospitality and Tourism Management. And Sybil Yang, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
So how do most people read a menu?
Wow. Well, it really depends on what type of menu it is. So for most menus that have a two-page layout, we find that people kind of revert back to what they're used to, which is reading a book or reading a magazine. So people try to get a lay of the land by reading it like a book. So starting on the upper left-hand corner and kind of making their way down, and then back to the top of the next page, and then back down. We're actually currently running studies, eye tracker studies, on how people look at a three-page menu to see if that changes at all, just because there's more stimulus in front of the guest. But for the most part, how they end up looking at it is just getting a lay of the land and then kind of honing in on what's going to be the center of their meal and then composing the rest of the meal around that center.
And do they generally, or do we generally, read an entire menu?
We scan the entire menu. So reading speed-wise, we see that when people get a lay of the land, they're reading at about the speed that they're going to kind of peruse for the amount of knowledge for studying for a multiple choice exam, let's say, instead of like, you know, if you're going to write an essay or if you're studying for a fill in the blank. So they read relatively fast. It's something that people call rotting, kind of like reading, scanning at the same time. So we scan the entire thing, but we don't actually read in depth the text, everything. It's really what picks up our eye that we end up really reading in depth.
And so I want to get back to you. Let me get you back in on the conversation, Dan Jurafsky. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's a great. It's great that Sybil can use eye tracking to study people as they're reading these menus. That's super.
And Sybil, you seem to take care of this fabled sweet spot. This idea that there's a sweet spot in a menu. You're saying maybe not.
So the sweet spot initially was the thought by a lot of marketers and psychologists out there that, and it really came from magazine studies to kind of see where people's eyes went back to repeatedly, and then also to look at where people look at first and last. And the initial thought was there was this one spot where eyes pass through a lot. It just happens to be when people look first and where people look last. But it really depends on the menu design and the menu layout. So there isn't really one spot where everybody tends to focus on because just designs are so varied.
What about pictures? How influential are pictures when on a menu?
I think at that point, pictures really are worth a thousand words. And especially if there is like just one picture on a page, it is so different that it really does attract the eye. If there are just too many pictures, so all of a sudden everything gets drowned out and you don't really see everything anymore. So the more unique something is, the more it's going to draw our attention.
And do people pick the entree first and then sort of go to the appetizer and then to the dessert?
Yeah, so when people kind of get their lay of the land, they generally try to find out where the center of their meal is going to be. So for most people, that's going to be the entrees. Or if you have like maybe an Italian menu, there will be like, I guess like a premium or a secondi that has relatively large portions. They'll kind of aim in for whatever the center of their meal is going to be. So it might not necessarily be like the huge meat, portion that we're probably used to as Americans, but just what they want the center of their meal to be. And then they'll plan, oh, is that a lot or a little? Do I need an appetizer to go along with it? Maybe not an app, then maybe I need something to share with a bunch of people. And they kind of plan out from there.
Dan, let me go back to you and ask you about the word entree. Is the word entree going out the window?
Entree does seem to be going out the window. So, you know, the history of entree is very interesting. It sounds like it means entrance. And in fact, in French, it means the appetizer. But originally it meant the entrance of the main meat course. So our American use of entree as the main course is actually the original use of the word entree. But it seems like more and more restaurants are saying something else. They're using a word like main or sometimes no word at all to talk about the main course. It's as if as restaurant French slowly is dying out of the menu as a sign of classy food, the word entree is going with it.
And does that tell us just about how much more diverse a country we are? And, you know, I mean, now that you can eat, it's just a smorgasbord of different countries and different foods from all over the world. Dan?
I think that's right. We're a nation of immigrants and immigrant cuisines, and there isn't a single model anymore of how to be a fancy restaurant. You can be a Japanese fancy restaurant, and you can be anything and be a fancy restaurant, not just, 1905, where to be a fancy restaurant, you really had to be in French.
Well, I wanted to, Sybil, and I mentioned my grandmother-in-law, and she absolutely, it was, you know, whatever was cheapest, that's the thing that she was going to eat at the meal. And, God bless her for that. How much does price matter, or prices that end in 99, you know, 0.99, does that matter?
Oh, my God, there's such a field about it. So a lot of what the restaurant wants to do is to create a feeling or create an affect for guests when they come on in. So what you find, and a lot of research has been conducted on this, is restaurants overall will choose one type of ending type for their prices in order to connote a certain feeling. So you'll find that value restaurants will tend to end in a 9 of some sort. Higher-end frou-frouer restaurants, fancier places, will tend to end in zeros or not have decimal points, as if to say, you know, oh, it's just chump change. We're not worrying about those cents at the very end. So in that respect, the price ending does matter. Whether we spell out, like, you know, the price in dollars, like $20, or if you put on decimal points, or if we even put a dollar sign on there, if there's a constant reminder of money, then we find that people start thinking about money and tend to spend a little less. So price is used in that respect. And we also see price being used as almost decoys, because people tend not to want to be, you know, the most expensive. They don't want to choose the most expensive thing on the menu. And unlike your grandmother, they don't necessarily want to choose the cheapest thing on the menu either. So they kind of, you place decoy prices in there to kind of push people to a certain option on the menu.
Dan, do linguists look at things like price?
Numbers? They do, but we're kind of more interested in the words. So, but the idea that just adding the word dollars can make people less interested in something, that's linguistic. That's great.
And what do you mean by decoys, Sybil?
Oh, so
how does that work?
So oftentimes you'll find that a restaurant offers items simply because they have to. So let's see. If we're talking about a bistro and there's a burger, the burger is generally pretty low margin, and the restaurant probably doesn't want to sell it because they won't make as much money on it. But they have to offer it because that's just the type of restaurant they are. And so what they'll do is they'll try to put in fancier, more descriptive items around the burger. So maybe there's a plain burger. Then they'll add in, like, the bacon blue cheeseburger next to it to kind of... Well, I guess that's not quite it. Okay, let me put together.
That's okay. That was interesting in and of itself.
So the Hooters menu, right?
Okay.
Not like we all eat at Hooters, but they have like a series of wings. So they'll have like the 10-piece wing meal, the 20-piece wing meal, and then they have this like 40-piece wing meal with a bottle of Dom Perignon. And I'm like, why is anybody ordering like a bottle of Dom at like Hooters? And all of a sudden, with that bottle of Dom, you have a $200 price point on the menu.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, that 20-piece plate of wings, it's not the highest price. And all of a sudden, it doesn't seem all that unreasonable because you just have this huge price there. Nobody takes the price seriously because it's a bottle of Dom with some wings. But all of a sudden, the rest of the menu is put in a cheaper context. That would be the perfect decoy right there.
Does that make sense to you, Dan?
Yeah, that's brilliant.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Let me just reintroduce the two of you. Talking with Sybil Yang, and she's an assistant professor at San Francisco State University's Department of Hospitality and Tourism, and she has studied how people read menus. She also consults on menu design. Dan Jurafsky is a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University, and he's written a book called The Language of Food, and it's subtitled A Linguist Reads the Menu, and we want to know what you think about what we're talking about here on Radio Times. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You certainly have experience reading menus. We want your reaction. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Sybil, I was talking with Dan about menus for sort of high-end restaurants where it's maybe two pages and not a lot of words, and at more sort of low-end restaurants, many more choices. Is there a point at which a menu just offers too many choices that it's just plain overwhelming for a consumer?
Wow. way back when, people probably would have said, yes, you don't want to overwhelm the guest, and then all of a sudden Cheesecake Factory comes along with their, like, 20-page menu. It really depends on what the restaurant is about, because if you think of a menu as just a list of choices, then what is a wine list doing being, like, the size of a telephone book either?
Yeah, right.
So at a certain point, you do want to offer the choices that the guests have, but if the purpose of the restaurant is to provide an experience, like a... If you go to a place like Morimoto's or like Budokan or something, you're going there for the experience. That is not just necessarily the food that's going to be served out to you, but also the ambiance, the interaction with the server. And so a lot of times you might even find that the menu is crafted to engage conversation with the server also. You might throw out these esoteric locational words or ingredients because you want the people to engage in conversation with the servers, because that's what the entire experience is about. You're kind of expected to be there for like an hour, hour and a half in a dining experience. But then if you go to like a Denny's or if you go to an IHOP, the key isn't about the experience. It's about, you know, getting some
a lot of food
into your
for
belt.
Not
yeah.
a lot of money.
Exactly. And you're not going to be, you know, dining there for an hour and a half either. So the purpose of the menu is really to inform, like take the burden of speaking off of the server, really. The server will just be your order taker. And so a lot more of the explanatoriness and every single option that's possible will, I would think, most likely is put out on the menu, where if you went to a high-end restaurant and said, you know, I want this to be medium rare, I don't want the sauce like on top of it, they're not going to say that you have that option. It's just kind of implicit.
Well, to you, Dan, and Sybil mentioned wine, and as we know, all the sort of language that's been built up around describing wines. Have you looked at that?
I haven't looked at that, but there's been some lovely linguistic studies of wine. So, you know, for example, how you describe a wine. And I'm sure Sybil can talk about some of this too. How you describe a wine affects whether people are likely to choose it or not. How even the color of a wine, you can put red dye in a wine and that causes people to describe, you know, a white wine dyed red. They'll describe it, even experts, as if it was a red wine.
Oh, wow.
So people are very influenced by the words and the color and things around. Our tastes are very subjective.
Indeed they are. Sybil, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think so much of what we're expecting and even actually feeling and tasting and thinking about a food is, you know, how the food is described to us and what it looks like to us. And so if we can change that perception up front, just like Dan said, if our expectations change, then the actual taste will oftentimes change. And when we have influential people like, you know, Robert Parker or so write just this rave review saying that it tastes like lush berries and, you know, again, like Dan described, very sexy, sexy words on a wine, all of a sudden when people drink it, they're going to think that it's full and voluptuous and, and you know, so I think it's very much a self-fulfilling prophecy on a lot of it.
Let me get Susan from Hocus in Delaware to join our conversation. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks
Hi
for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi.
You're on the air.
I had a question about restaurants and how they name their dishes. And I'm remembering back to a night out in college when a friend and I went to Denny's and she ordered Moons Over My Hammy. So, I mean, they're actually like saying this completely ridiculous menu item, but, you know, that's how you have to order it, you know,
right.
Versus going to a nicer restaurant where the waiter will go through the specials and it's like, you know, sea bass and then this whole list of things and you go, I'll have the fish, you know, and I just wonder how that changes our perception, you know, when you have to say something completely ridiculous, like Moons Over My Hammy.
Yes.
Or, you know, you get the whole list of ingredients and then you just kind of go, fish.
Fish. Susan, it's a great question. I'm going to start with you, Dan. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, certainly the use of humor, you see it, I think, traditionally more often in the lower-end restaurants. This is, you know, it's okay to be funny in a diner, and there's this tradition of funny names. But you're starting to see it in more upscale places. You're starting to see a little more hipster humor. So I think the idea that you know, the fancy restaurants take themselves very seriously, but maybe there's starting to be a little element of play in that.
Sybil, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think the humor element, psychologists would say that it's to create a positive affect and to make you feel kind of we can be confused by positive feelings, so we don't know where the positive feeling is necessarily coming from. So if we say a funny name like Moons Over My Hammy and it makes you laugh, you might kind of translate that positive feeling to, hey, if I'm laughing and I'm smiling, it's probably because I like this dish for some reason, and you might be more likely to order it. So the next time you look over, you know, a Denny's menu or something, I would suggest that you look over the items and see which items they're actually using these kind of affective names for, and those are usually the items that they're trying to sell you. So the very, very low margin, just like, you know, two eggs and bacon or something, probably won't have that affectual name. But there's a great researcher out at Cornell. What is his name? Oh, he's going to kill me.
That's
Brian
okay.
Wanthink. Brian Wanthink, who came out with descriptive labels, like categories of descriptive labels for items, and generally items with, you know, geographical listings, a brand name associated with it, and affectual results to that name, will try to, you know, will encourage people to buy more.
Well, Dan, let me ask you, because you've also, this is in your book about, for instance, how we say certain words, the names of crispy foods, the names of rich, heavy foods, and literally, you know, what part of our mouth those words come out of. Can you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, explain
that. We call
that.
It sound symbolism. So there's two kinds of vowels linguists talk about. We call them front vowels and back vowels. So in a front vowel, your tongue is kind of in the front of the mouth. And a front vowel is a vowel like E, I, E. You can say them out loud. You can kind of feel yourself smiling as your tongue moves to the front of your mouth. And back vowels are vowels like ah, aw, oh. They're round, kind of big vowels. And it turns out that across lots of languages, front vowels are used to describe small things. So in English, we have words like little, itsy bitsy, teeny weeny. They're all I and E vowels. French has petite. You know, you have these E vowels in small words. And we have O and U vowels for big words, huge and humongous and enormous. And it's not, you know, true for every word, but it's a very strong tendency. And it turns out this is true in food naming as well. So think about cracker names, Ritz, Wheat Thins, Triscuit, Crispy, Cheez-Its. All is and E's. But think about ice cream brand names, ice cream flavor names. So Rocky Road, Jamocha Almond Fudge, Chocolate, Cookie Dough, Coconut. It's all O's and U's and U's. So, you know, you want crackers to be light and thin and small and crispy. So subconsciously, by giving them that I or E vowel, we're making us, it'll feel to us like it's a small, crispy little thing. But you want ice cream to be big and plump and solid. And sure enough, we have these ah names for our ice creams.
Well, we're going to take another short break. We have to say goodbye to you, Sybil Yang. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. And again, assistant professor at San Francisco State University's Department of Hospitality and Tourism Management. And she's been studying how people read menus, and she also consults on menu design. We're going to carry on our conversation with Dan Jurafsky again, professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University, author of a book called The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, again talking with Dan Jurafsky about his book called The Language of Food. He's a linguist, and it's subtitled A Linguist Reads the Menu. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And I have an email here at radiotimes@whyy.org, and this is from Robert. He says, when I see home style, in quotations, on food packaging, I consider this to be a positive assessment. What do you make of home style? What does it mean to you, Dan?
Yeah, so we looked at exactly that word, home style and homemade and homey and these kind of home words. And it turns out we looked at them both on restaurant menus and on advertising like potato chip bags. And as you might expect, these tend to occur on the cheaper menus and on the cheaper chips. So there's something that we call traditional authenticity. If you want to express that you're a down-home restaurant, or you're an, you know, all-American potato chip, that you might talk about your mom, you might talk about the founder of the company and the potato chip, the menu might talk about grandma's special. So you're sort of appealing to the family down-home nature. Now that's going to be your cheaper restaurants and your cheaper chips.
We have another email. This is from Peter. He says, I recently served a guest an apple pie made from apples from our tree. I presented it as locally sourced organic apples from a neighborhood terroir, non-GMO, artisanally sliced and prepared, fair trade, no sugar added, but with a small batch of organic honey and dolphin free. He says, seriously, no problem with the longer words, but why, oh, why can't they just tell us what it means? I mean, do you think some restaurants just go just way too far on this sort of fancy language?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think maybe there's a backlash, just like your writer is suggesting, and maybe that's why the fancy restaurants are starting to go with the shorter menus. Now you're getting just a much briefer list of ingredients. Often, a mysterious, complicated word, maybe as Sybil suggests, it's a way to get the customers to ask the waiter what's going on, but not, these long, very flowery descriptions that used to be true of very expensive menus. We're seeing less of them, although we still do see a lot of this language around provenance. Most of those examples on the apple, it's all about where the food is from.
Exactly.
We seem to be obsessed right now about where things are coming from.
Let me ask you about macaroni, because you've written about the rise of macaroni, the fall of macaroni, and now the rise of macaroni, I guess, and cheese.
Yes, macaroni. Historically, I love the fact that names of food can tell you so much about history. So macaroni, macaroons, macarons, it's all the same word historically. It's really the confluence of many cultures. So the Moors come to Sicily and they bring these amazing, fabulous desserts from the Arab world and the Persian world, all these almond pastries, and they all appear in 13th century Sicily all at the same time. So you get this word macaroni, and it means something like what we now call gnocchi. It's like a fluffy rose water sugar. It had these very, Middle Eastern spices in it. But very quickly, a similar word begins to mean not what we call now a macaroon, but more what we call now marzipan. It meant marzipan, sometimes wrapped in dough, again, borrowed from the Middle East. And the word, so the idea was that the same word could mean a pastry or a pasta. And in fact, the words pastry and pasta themselves are related. And it was a very fancy food. The word macaroni in England was used to refer to these dandies who would go abroad to Italy in the 1700s and eat this weird foreign food, pasta. And so you called them macaronis because you named them by this weird hipster food that they ate. And of course now macaroni is just an all-American food. So this idea that exotic imported foods start out as this fancy thing and slowly become our everyday foods.
Well, I think what's interesting, even and perhaps this macaroni and cheese, is that, this sort of people food or even comfort food. But again, you see it showing up more in some, fancy restaurants. They might throw some other ingredients in, but it seems like macaroni and cheese is, back on top.
Yeah, there's certainly a trope now of taking all American foods, comfort foods, and playing with them. So the sort of deconstruction. I think I've had three times at fancy restaurants a deconstructed s'more where they make a dessert that's like s'more. So yeah, there's something that's certainly going around. Everybody's copying this idea of deconstructing comfort foods in fancy restaurants.
We have an email from Frank. He says, it strikes me that socioeconomic class has at least as much to do with how people talk about food as linguistics. Do you agree with him?
Oh, absolutely. Linguists are find that socioeconomic class is a really important factor, one of the most important factors in how people talk differently. If you look at the variation in how people talk, and language of food is just one of the important ways people talk, when we're looking at price on a menu, it's really a marker of sociolinguistic class. People, mm-hmm. Fancy restaurants trying to say we're fancy, we're high class. So yeah, absolutely, I completely agree with the caller.
Do you watch food shows on TV, and have you deconstructed any of the linguistics or the language used there?
I haven't yet. The kids in my freshman class, they're obsessed with the food shows.
And, the Food Channel, right?
Yeah, and so I need to. That's like a study I need to do next.
Let me get looks like Elizabeth from Downingtown to join our conversation. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I have a pet peeve. I really can't appreciate misspellings on menus. Sometimes it almost makes me want to leave the restaurant, and I wonder how your guest feels about that.
Misspellings. That's a great one.
So yeah, go
there's
ahead.
Something visceral about misspellings. And I think it's, you know, historically related. Maybe it's related to how, to this question about social class. You know, spelling in English, if you think about it, English has a very difficult spelling system. So, you know, Spanish has a very easy, for example, has a very, lots of Romance languages have easy spelling systems. What you, the way you write it is the way you pronounce it. And English historically has a very difficult one. And the sociologist Veblen argued in the turn of the last century, he said the English has this complicated system, and so we use it as a way of marking education. You know, back then there wasn't universal education 150 years ago, and so, you know, if you could spell, you were probably a high class person, and so being unable to spell was really a mark of being uneducated, illiterate kind of person. And I think that attitude persists in us kind of subconsciously. So when we see bad spelling or what we think of as bad grammar, it's as if we're imposing this moral judgment. Maybe, you know, they're not like us. They're not educated like us. They're different in some way. It's a very subconscious and visceral response that many people have.
But I wonder whether it goes back to what Sybil was mentioning about being clever or cute or even funny on a menu. So if something is misspelled on purpose, whether they're trying to sort of engage you in this kind of friendly way.
I see. Yeah, I see. Yeah, a purposeful misspelling. Yeah, I think that's probably right. That's probably cutesy rather than illiterate. Yeah.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're talking about reading menus, the language of menus. And again, Dan Jurafsky, our guest, the author of a book called The Language of Food. And we're looking for your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You have a whole section here on Turkey, sort of how come Turkey is named, you know, there's a country named Turkey and then there's a turkey named Turkey. And take us through the history of that particular word and that particular bird, too.
Yeah, it's another case where the name of the food tells you not just about food, but about world history. So imagine that you're in 1500 and you want to buy spices. Where do you go? Okay, you go to Kerala, India, to Calicut. The black pepper and spices are being sold, and the Ottomans and the Venetian traders are there, and the Portuguese, they want to break in on this spice trade. So they figure out how to sail all the way around Africa to reach India directly by sea from Portugal. And along the way, they establish colonies in West Africa, and they've got colonies, they've got Brazil, they've got colonies in the New World. And where are they bringing all the products from all these colonies to sell in Europe? They're bringing them to Antwerp, up in Northern Europe. And Antwerp's where the British bring their woolens, and the Germans bring their copper, and the Dutch bring their herring, and everybody's trading all this stuff. And Portugal had a very strict rule of secrecy. So no publications of any maps or any charts. In fact, it was the death penalty for giving out charts to foreigners. They didn't want anybody knowing how to get to India or where their West African colonies were. So they were bringing, for example, they were bringing the turkeys from the New World. They probably got them from the Spanish. And they were bringing from Africa a different bird that we now call the guinea fowl, but at the time we called the turkey cock, because originally the Turks had played a role in importing it into Europe through Egypt. So here's these two birds. They're both black speckled birds, and one called the turkey cock. And they both arrive. They're in Antwerp. People are buying these birds, and the Portuguese will not say where they're from. In fact, the person selling the birds may have no idea, but only the captain of the ship knew which bird came from where. And so the birds are immediately confused. And for hundreds of years, everyone was confused between turkeys and guinea fowls, and until Shakespeare gets it wrong, until, you know, maybe the late 1500s, when finally people figure out that these are two separate birds. And then turkeys become extremely popular in Europe, and in fact in England it was the standard bird for harvest festivals and Christmases. So when the pilgrims came to America, they brought the turkeys with them because that's what they had for Christmas. And so the idea of turkey as a Thanksgiving, you know, kind of harvest feast bird is in fact an old English tradition that the colonists brought with them.
Well, speaking of Thanksgiving and pecan pies, there's pecan, and pecan.
Yes, there's a great study about how people in different parts of America pronounce different words. You know, as countries go, American English is not that diverse compared to, you know, China or Italy, where people, you know, if they speak Sicilian, they can't really talk to people in the north at all. So, you know, here we can talk to everybody, but we definitely have regional differences. And a great study by Bert Vox showed that you could actually predict where people were from based on how they described different words. So, so pecan is the word, the pronunciation used in the region where actually the pecan tree is from. So that's, you know, the eastern Texas and western Louisiana region. And whereas you get pecan in the northeast and you get pecan in the west. And but the reason probably that the word pecan is the word is the pronounced the way it is in that region where the pecan tree exists is that's closer to the word. It was borrowed from the Native American word for the tree, which was pecani, so much closer to the word. So the original word really still survives in the region near where the people who made up the word lived.
Let me get looks like B from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, B, go ahead. You're on the air.
I am listening to your show, and I'm driving behind a car that has a bumper sticker that has a picture of an Italian flag, and it says on it, it's sauce. Or, I'm sorry, it's gravy, not sauce. As a child of someone growing up in South Philadelphia, we call it gravy. If you go into a restaurant, it's called sauce. What does your guest think of the difference between a regional word like gravy and something you see in a restaurant like sauce?
It's a good question.
How does that change?
No, it's a great question.
No, that's a great question.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
There's lots of words like that. I mean, like your local use of the words of sauce versus gravy, or you know, what you call a you know, that your hoagies versus your grinders versus your hero sandwiches. There are a number of really interesting regionalisms in food vocabulary. Not huge numbers, you know. It's, again, we can all talk to each other. We're a pretty homogenous language, actually, as big countries go. But yeah, they're fascinating, I think, these differences, and they make people comfortable using the words of the place you grew up in. It's homey.
B, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Dan, you have an interesting section on the word toast. We you know, lift a glass of wine or champagne at a celebration. We are toasting them, and of course, we know it's a breakfast food as well. What's the connection between these two?
Yeah, the original meaning of both words was actually the grilling word. So the original meaning was grilled bread, and the idea that how it got to talk about alcohol was that we used to put toast into alcohol. So it was very common to take toast, add spices to it like ginger and galangal, really great medieval spices, and you put them in the wine, and you would heat up the wine a little bit and add spice to it, and that's how we drank wine. You also put toast in soup. So this idea of you know, a thin drinking the wine just for the taste of the grapes and the, you know, in those days it was a much more substantive kind of thing to drink. And just as this idea of drinking wine with toast in it was dying out, say about in the 1700s, it became very common to drink people's health at dinner. So you might have lots of rounds of drinking the health of the lady of the evening or the belle of the ball. And people began to call her the toast, saying that she spiced the evening just like the toast spices the wine. So we would call her the toast. And then slowly we began to talk about toasting people.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye here, it's so interesting to think of foods that go in and out of favor. You know, a year ago, people were goo goo gaga about cupcakes, and now, you know, cupcakes are, they're totally not cool. Do you follow things like that?
Oh, yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, the fact that macarons, you know, the French macarons were very in, I don't know, maybe it was 5 years ago, it's fascinating. And of course, macaron is the same word as macaroon. That's already linguistically interesting. But also the idea that foods that, the macarons began as this fancy imported food, and you know, now you can buy them at Costco. It's again just like macaroni. You know, foods, they're imported by the rich, and they're a sign of being expensive and high class. And slowly these ideas trickle down, just like wanting to know where your food is from. It's only on the fancy menus, but slowly, you know, that kind of idea creeps into the middle price menus. So the expensive stuff trickles down to everybody.
Well, Dan Jurevsky, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marie.
You're
it's
welcome.
Been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And he's a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University, author of The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Quinn Libsyn, our intern this fall. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.